This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers were in New York City last week to demand that Wendy's end farm worker exploitation.
Every other fast food chain has signed with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. When will Wendy's do it? We'll hear from some of the people from the CIW who are on the march from Union Square to Wendy's.
We'll also speak with Fahd Ahmed, a Muslim American here in New York City, about the utter blanket surveillance that the police force here in New York City have thrown over the Muslim community.
You know, people ought to be screaming about this. The idea that you can designate a part of the community and spy on it and disrupt it is so outrageous. But somehow, we're not seeing the uprising we should have against those programs.
Government shutdown, the debt ceiling, what's going on?
Yes, the Tea Party's to blame, but Obama's been right in there with the best of them, cutting Medicare and Social Security. Professor Jack Rasmus tells us more.
Stay with us.
City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Last week, we gave you an update on the U.S. kidnapping of Abu Anas Alibi in Tripoli and their attack on someone they claimed was from al-Shabaab in Somalia. This week, we have another short update on Abu Anas Alibi. We left him on some ship floating around somewhere in the world while he was going to be interrogated by U.S. officials. In my view, an illegal interrogation. He is under indictment in the United States, and he should have been brought here for trial, given a lawyer, given his Miranda warnings, etc. But the U.S. said, we're going to interrogate him. And of course, as we know, they can use techniques that really, in my view, could amount to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and torture for the interrogation. But here's the update. While I thought then that he might be floating around for a month or two, all of a sudden, last week, he appears in a federal district court in Manhattan. Why did he appear? Apparently, he was quite sick when they picked him up. He has hepatitis C, and then he went on a hunger strike. And I guess they figured he's getting sicker, they can't treat him, and they have no way of interrogating him and getting, quote, whatever information he might have. So they brought him here. He was arraigned in front of a federal court, pled not guilty. Now he'll be assigned an attorney. He was arraigned by a legal aid attorney. We don't know who we'll get. So we'll keep following this case. It'll be interesting to see what, if anything, he said while he was floating around on that ship. The big news from a national security perspective, from Snowden documents, from WikiLeaks, etc., is that the well-known journalist Glenn Greenwald is leaving The Guardian. He's leaving it to set up his own journalistic organization. What he said about that is, one of the best parts of doing this is participating in building a media organization from scratch. I can shape its mission, how it functions, what its objectives are, and most importantly, help to choose the people I am working with. And he said what he wants to do, and that he's setting out to, quote, pursue adversarial accountability journalism is the kind of ideology that he will have. So it's an important development. And my guess is, again a guess, is that he will then be able to publish material that perhaps other big media was unwilling to publish. So look forward to what Glenn Greenwald and others may wind up doing with this important new journalistic organization. Here at Law and Disorder, we've been covering the struggles of the farm workers in Immokalee, Florida, to try and get corporations, supermarkets, food chains, etc., to pay a penny a pound more for tomatoes and to sign the Fair Food Agreement. Among fast food companies, only Wendy's is still holding out, Every other one has signed. Last week, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers came into town. One of the reasons they came into town was to receive the 2013 Four Freedoms Award. The reward the Coalition of Immokalee Workers received was the Freedom from Want Award. While they were here, they again did a demonstration in front of the Wendy's store off Union Square. It was a wonderful, militant, strong demonstration against Wendy's, and we're going to bring you some live coverage of that demonstration. So by this show, we're asking you to support CIW and particularly to support their struggle to get Wendy's to sign the Fair Food Agreement and pay the farmers one penny more a pound.
We're standing in a picket line with a lot of red signs with tomatoes on them in front of Wendy's on 14th Street. And we're here with Santiago Perez from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Santiago, tell us what we're trying to accomplish here.
Bueno, estamos aquí. Primero, buenas tardes. Estamos aquí porque estamos luchando que esta corporación también sea parte del cambio que ya tenemos con 11 corporaciones que estamos trabajando juntos.
Good afternoon. And the reason why we're here is in front of Wendy's today in Union Square is because we're trying to force Wendy's, like we have 11 other major multi-billion dollar corporations, to join the Fair Food Program, which is our solution to abuse in the fields.
Can you tell me, Santiago, in a nutshell, what the Fair Food Program is doing for the tomato pickers in Florida?
El programa por comida justa es de que nosotros queremos que todo lo que venga de diferentes sectores sea con justicia. Y por eso, hoy en día, ya tenemos cuatro corporaciones grandes como McDonald's, Taco Bell, Burger King, Subway, y nos falta Wendy's, que es otra de las corporaciones grandes de comida rápida.
The Fair Food Program is a mechanism that ensures our rights, that ensures justice in the fields for farm workers, rights that we've been denied for decades, centuries. And interestingly, four of the largest fast food corporations in the country have already joined the Fair Food Program. And strangely enough, Wendy's still refuses to join this proven solution.
And for those companies that have joined the Fair Food Program, how are things different for the workers?
El papel muy importante que juegan estas corporaciones es que ellos tienen el poder. Son las corporaciones que ponen el precio a los rancheros. Entonces, estamos necesitando de estas corporaciones grandes para que nos ayuden a liberar a tanto trabajador de la esclavitud moderna que hay todavía en lo que es en la industria agrícola.
Well, we went to those major corporations because we recognized that it was their massive purchasing power that they would leverage in order to demand artificially low prices of produce. And so we've demanded that those corporations abide by a few basic provisions in the fields.
Bueno, hoy lo que estamos pidiendo es que las corporaciones paguen un centavo más por libra de tomate que compren y sobre todo que firmen un código de conducta, que es el respeto a los trabajadores y cero tolerancia al acoso sexual a las mujeres.
We've demanded that those corporations do two basic things. One is pay a penny more per pound for their tomatoes, which gets distributed through the supply chain and out to workers into our checks, and is an important difference in our pay. And the second is that they enforce a code of conduct, a worker design code of conduct. They only buy from farms that comply with workers' rights. And this enshrines things like basic respect for workers, as well as zero tolerance for things like sexual harassment and modern day slavery, which has still been rampant in the fields in the last two decades.
What were things like for you, Santiago, when you first started out as a farm worker?
Bueno, hace dos años todavía las condiciones en el campo, los trabajadores no tenían ni derecho de ir a tomar agua. Tienen que trabajar 10 horas, piscar 153 cubetas de tomate. Estamos hablando de 2.5 toneladas de tomate piscada por un trabajador en un día para ganar el salario mínimo.
Farm work is dangerous, back-breaking work. It's incredibly challenging. And in our work in the tomato industry, up until really just 2 years ago, in our typical 10-hour work days, in order to walk away at the end of the day having received the equivalent of minimum wage via our pace rate, we would have had to have picked over 150 buckets. That's 2.5 tons of tomatoes lifted and hauled in a day.
y tenemos el 90% de rancheros y las 11 corporaciones, pero estas 11 corporaciones no vinieron porque amanecieron de buena, no, amanecieron por la presión de los consumidores, que ellos tienen el poder grande sobre las corporaciones.
But the good news is that things are changing. We've seen a massive transformation in the fields as a result of those 11 corporations coming to the table. Now, why did they come to the table? Did they wake up one morning and decide to do the good thing out of the goodness of their hearts? No, we forced them to the table. We forced them to the table with so many people, consumers, community members, who demanded that they change their practices.
Santiago Perez, what can our listeners do to support the Coalition of Immokalee Workers?
Bueno, lo que la gente puede hacer en cualquier estado es mandar cartas a los managers de Wendy's para que ellos se unan a la campaña que estamos trabajando hoy juntos. Gracias a esa campaña, hoy los trabajadores tienen el derecho de reportar algún abuso en el trabajo o por lo menos de tomar agua.
If anybody would like to get involved, what they can do just to begin is to print out a manager letter and take it into their local Wendy's, even if they're not a consumer of it, to put that same kind of pressure on Wendy's today that has been so successful in the past.
We've been speaking with Santiago Perez with the able translation from Elena Stein. Come all the way down from Immokalee, Florida, here at 14th Street near Union Square. We're standing outside of Wendy's, and we wish you two every success. Thank you.
Okay, gracias. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Daniel Gross. I'm with Brand Workers. Our members work in the food production factories in Brooklyn and Queens, and they use the tomatoes that our fellow workers in Immokalee are harvesting. The CIW is one of our major partners. They are one of the leading lights impacting the labor movement from coast to coast. We're absolutely dumbfounded that Wendy's is on the wrong side of history. So many of the leaders in fast food have already gotten on the boat. It's just absolutely incomprehensible that Wendy's will choose the wrong side of history. We know they're gonna do the right thing, and we're ready for them to do it now. The CIW has really broken new ground in labor, and their strategy has just been brilliant. It's to tell the truth about what's happening in Immokalee and to ask customers whether the values that Wendy's is currently demonstrating is compatible with their values. It's clear that the values of the consuming public have shifted, and Wendy's has to keep up if they want to continue to compete.
Daniel Gross, thanks so much for your time here. We're about to head off on the march.
Couldn't be more proud to be here. Brand Workers has been with the CIW for years, and we're going to be through the bitter moments and on to sweet victory when Wendy's does the right thing.
Kathy Albisa from the National Economic and Social Rights Network. And we're glad to see you, Kathy. Why are you here?
I'm here to support the Coalition of Immokalee Workers Fair Food Campaign. They're here to tell Wendy to join the Fair Food Agreements, which ask Wendy to sign up for only 1 penny per pound of tomatoes in terms of increased wages. Farm workers are the lowest paid workers in the country, as well as sign up for a code of conduct to protect against severe abuses in the fields like slavery, sexual harassment, violence, health hazards, etc. The agreements have been implemented since 2009. They've made a huge difference to up to 60,000 workers a year, and we need every large tomato purchaser to jump on board and make them sustainable and create a change for generations to come.
Thank you very much.
Wendy's, escucha, estamos en la lucha. Wendy's, escucha, estamos en la lucha. Wendy's, escucha.
My name is Naomi Wolf, and I'm here to support the agricultural workers who are being underpaid by the middlemen in Florida and across the country. But I'm especially impressed with the analysis that these groups have done of the fact that going after the middlemen is not really effective. The people who are suppressing these hardworking citizens' wages artificially are the people at the top of the corporations. And five of the biggest fast food organizations have accepted that they need to raise wages. The last holdout is Wendy's. So I'm here to show support, to raise awareness, and to confront the Wendy's here in my neighborhood to let them know that it's not okay to exploit farm workers in order to get cheap tomatoes and produce. So much time and energy is wasted not putting pressure on the people who are the ultimate decision makers. And public shame is a powerful motivator for change. I'm also impressed with how well organized this protest is, how thoughtful, how good the visuals are, how good the explanation is, and the fact that we're going to Wendy's and we're going to stand outside and engage in using our First Amendment rights outside, not blocking traffic, but raising awareness. But then a delegation is going inside to, I don't want to say confront, but to challenge the manager and negotiate, and we can, you know, hopefully we'll get as much attention for that as possible, because that is how you change public opinion. People don't want to, you know, get a cheap hamburger knowing that they're exploiting hardworking men and women with families out in the fields. That is not the American way. This is the American way. So I'm glad that we're using our First Amendment rights. And apart from the issue, I think it's very, very important in a time of crackdown on First Amendment freedom of assembly to come out and not just support the issues you care about, but use your First Amendment rights in your own hometown. I mean, I guess what I do know is that our food supply is increasingly in the hands of five or six multinational corporations and their lobbyists and the people they own in Congress, who are writing laws to mess up our food supply, control competition, suppress wages, and make us unhealthy and not give us choices. It's bad for farmers, it's bad for our families, it's bad for nutrition. So the more various stakeholders like these workers and consumers speak up and use their leverage, the more we break up that cartel, whether it's suppressed wages or GMOs or pollution or other forms of monopoly of the agricultural system.
Those were the voices recorded on the march from Union Square to Wendy's.
Earlier this month, the Federal District Court in Manhattan required the New York City Police Department to defend its Muslim spying program. The hearing lasted several hours and revealed how the NYPD Muslim spying program has targeted innocent Muslims based on nothing more than their faith. We're joined today by Fahd Ahmed, Legal and Policy Director with DRUM, an organization founded to empower South Asian low-wage immigrant workers, youth, and families, many of whom are Muslims here in New York City.
Fahd, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting.
Now, you're with an organization that I first became aware of after 9/11. It's called DRUM, but a lot of our listeners, I don't think, know what DRUM does, perhaps what you do there. But what is DRUM?
DRUM stands for Desis Rising Up and Moving. It is a community organization of low-income South Asians organizing for worker rights, immigrant rights, racial justice, police accountability, and educational justice. And we're a membership-based organization of about 2,000 low-income South Asians. So these are the folks that are directly affected by these issues, and they organize themselves. We help them organize to fight for the issues that affect their everyday lives.
Now, we in New York, of course, are aware of, at least some people are aware of, the New York Police Department's what I call the Muslim spying program. Can you talk about what that is and how it affects the community that you're with?
Yes. About 2 years ago, the Associated Press started releasing a series of articles that essentially confirmed what people in our communities had been feeling for many years, namely that the NYPD has an extensive spying network on the New York City Muslim communities, everywhere from their houses of worship to places of business to their work sites to their social networks. The way that they accomplished this is through the use of undercover officers, through the use of informants, many of whom are paid money for their services, and also through the use of surveillance equipment.
Let me ask about that. When you heard it, I don't know if you were a drum or not, but when the Muslim community heard about this, I mean, I know what my reaction is. I'm not a Muslim, and my reaction was it was unbelievable, and people should be screaming. But what was the reaction in the Muslim community? Did it get people frightened by it? And what was Drum's reaction at that point?
So first, Drum's reaction was very clearly of outrage. We obviously knew that this was going on beforehand. We have members in our organization that have been directly been targeted by the NYPD over the last 8-9 years. And so, you know, from their experiences, we knew that this was already happening. That said, the scope, both the extent and the depth of the program was quite surprising and outrageous for us. Beyond Drum, in the Muslim community, I think, you know, reactions were sort of spanned the spectrum. By and large, probably the major reaction was of outrage and shock as well. But then there was also folks who took the view that, you know, this really doesn't affect me personally, or that, you know, if we're not doing anything, then it really doesn't matter. But what we've seen through people that have been directly affected, that even if you're not doing anything wrong, this program is very bad for you, and people get targeted every day.
Can you give us some examples of those targeting? Obviously, without using names, if you don't, but just the types of,
yes,
of things.
So, coincidentally, just on the day that the first AP report came out, we had launched a survey project to collect both quantitative data and qualitative data on what's going on in New York City Muslim communities with regards to law enforcement. And the information that we've been getting from the surveys is quite astounding. So some anecdotes. We had one gentleman, Arab cab driver, who reported, cooperated with the police in the solving of a robbery. He was an eyewitness to the person that conducted the robbery. He testified in court. The person was convicted. The person was sent off to jail. The NYPD, seeing this as somebody that's willing to be cooperative with the police, then approached him several months later and said, "We'd like to talk to you about that case." He said, "Oh, the guy's in jail. What do you want to talk about?" And they said, "Oh, we just want to talk to you." And once they come to his house, they start a conversation. About 2 minutes into the conversation, they tell him, "We want you to become an informant for us." And he's completely shocked. And when he declines, for the next 2 weeks, he ends up being followed around town in dark, unmarked cars.
Unbelievable.
He's a cab driver. So that means for 12 hours a day, significant months of those times, he's being followed around in unmarked cars by the police. They're trying to pressure him to become an informant.
And if he makes any mistake, like doesn't put his turn signal on or something, they can bust him on the spot.
Yeah, and then he says, cancel the ticket or I don't play ball. You know, it's just as unbelievable. So I'm paying my tax money for this kind of blanket surveillance. My question, Fahd, is they've been doing this now quite completely for many years. What's been the yield? Have they gotten any convictions for people attempting terrorist acts? Have they gotten any arrests?
Yeah. You know, the NYPD claims a large number, I forget what the number is at right now, but a significant number of those cases, the ones that they like to claim, are actually FBI cases. That said, both the numbers for the NYPD and the FBI, even the cases where they have gotten convictions, you know, there's a lot of questions in the community about the veracity, the strength of those cases. You know, when you send a, you know, the NYPD and the FBI are spending millions of dollars for these surveillance programs. And when they send undercovers and informants in for years, they've consistently found that the people that they want to target are not interested, have no interest in any acts of terrorism. And when they get turned away from their prime targets, because so much money has gone into these programs, they then have to sort of produce results. And then they target vulnerable people. So taking the NYPD, the three cases that they do cite, the first case was the Herald Square plot, Shahwar Mateen Siraj, whose family are actually members of Drum, and James El Shafei. Mateen Siraj is somebody that has an IQ of 78, is very gullible, very manipulable, very friendly person, but somebody that can easily be manipulated. And his co-defendant, James El Shafei, was a paranoid schizophrenic and had been in and out of mental health institutions for many years. And the informant in that case was paid $100,000.
Did the informant have anything to do with encouraging these two people to do anything criminal?
Definitely from the family's perspective, from the community's perspective, and from our perspective, yes.
Okay, so that's one BS case. What about the second one?
The second case that we saw was in May of 2011, Ahmed Farhani and Mohammed Mamadou, two young men that were targeted by a NYPD undercover officer. In that case, Mamadou really sort of had very tangential, he just happened to be at the wrong place on the day that the bust happened. Ahmed Farhani was somebody, again, that had a long history of depression, of bipolar disorder, and the undercover officer had spent, after having failed in multiple other parts of the city and multiple other communities, identified this person who he developed a relationship with, gained his trust, and said essentially, if you work with me, you know, I'll get you some money. And interspersed in those conversations are references to terrorism. And Farhani is really just interested in the money, but kind of goes along with the conversation for the sake of getting to the money. And, you know, this is a similar pattern that we see in most of these cases, that the people that they end up targeting are people that are very easily manipulable and vulnerable, or have their own interests, whether they are under the influence of substance abuse, they're dealing with financial problems, they're dealing with mental health problems. Those are really the only people that they end up successfully targeting.
I want to go back for a second to where we began with the whole program of spying on the Muslim community, which these cases are obviously a product of. We've been amazed that this can go on in a city that claims to obey a constitution or equal rights. Has there been some litigation around this issue by either Drum or other people?
Yes. There's currently three lawsuits. The first lawsuit, and the one going the furthest back, is obviously the Hanshu lawsuit, which was filed a few decades ago in response to the NYPD surveillance of activists. The Hanshu case, you know, set guidelines for how the police could conduct surveillance, what records they could keep. The attorneys on that case believe, and the communities believe, that the current NYPD spying program is in violation of that. So there's a reopening of Hanshu in to try to roll back some of the requirements to go back to the initial requirements that used to be on the NYPD, some of which were loosened in the aftermath of 9/11. And then very specifically to these spying programs, there's one lawsuit pending in New Jersey being run by the Center for Constitutional Rights and Muslim Advocates, which focuses on the NYPD spying on New Jersey communities. A lot of that, while looking at issues of the chilling effect, also kind of raises a lot of jurisdictional issues about the NYPD being in New Jersey. Recently, in New York City, the case was filed, I believe, in the Eastern District, being led by the ACLU and the CUNY CLEAR project at the CUNY School of Law, which is really looking at the impact, the chilling effect of these spying programs on Muslim communities, on mosques, on community organizations, and on individuals.
We're speaking with Fahd Ahmed of Drum, who has been helping to organize the resistance to this blanket spying on Muslims in New York and New Jersey. Fahd, what do we who care about democratic rights and representative government and are trying to push back this police state spying, what do we want to get out of these three various lawsuits?
The lawsuits aren't just ends in themselves. We understand that this is a much larger and much more protracted struggle. Obviously, other communities have been dealing with similar types of overreach by the NYPD for decades, and our community is just sort of the news community on the front lines of this targeting right now. So for us, it's important that the legal strategy is coordinated with the community organizing and advocacy that's been taking place. Recently, in New York City, we had a major victory with the passage of the Community Safety Act, which brings some oversight and restrictions on the NYPD with regards to profiling. And we really have to pull all of these pieces together, the legal strategy, the policy change, and the grassroots organizing, to really build the power of our communities, because we understand that this keeps happening. It's a repeated pattern with the NYPD. And, you know, whether it's stop and frisk, whether it's the surveillance, whether it's the targeting of activists, there is just a presumption of you're guilty until we prove you innocent, and even then you're so guilty that the NYPD seems to operate on. What we're trying to do is sort of pull all these strategies together to really build the power of communities. Powerful communities then have a greater ability to keep the state power in check, to keep the police state from expanding and overreaching.
How many police do you think are involved in this at the city and state and federal level? Do you have any estimate about that, or any estimate of the kind of monies they're spending against us?
That is one of the things that we're still trying to figure out, both the budget of the Intelligence Department and the size of their personnel. We do believe that it's at least a few hundred in terms of officers in the Intelligence Department, but we don't have a specific number. We also understand that the numbers are not limited just to the officers. Given the network of informants that they've developed, you know, their reach is much more expansive. Just as an anecdote, when the Mateen Siraj case was happening, in the testimony, there's a moment in the court that it comes out that during one prayer session in a mosque in Bay Ridge, there was five either undercover officers or informants present in the mosque for the same prayer. So five in a relatively small mosque, a mosque of about a couple hundred people, that's a pretty high percentage. And so if we extrapolate that to the rest of the city, and, you know, the NYPD documents clearly seem to indicate that it's across the full scope of the city, and almost all mosques are being listed, then that's a pretty astounding number.
It's shocking and repulsive. In the same way, saying rounding up all the Japanese Americans in California and putting them in a concentration camp on the grounds that they weren't going to be loyal during the Second World War is shocking and repulsive. What's so amazing is that after 9/11, there was never any really discussion about who did 9/11. And it was just blamed on Muslims in particular, instead of the 17 people from Saudi Arabia who did it, who were part of a particular Wahhabi sect. But I think it's the same kind of overall racism that was used against the Japanese that's used against Muslims, who are from many different countries and different walks of life, and all of a sudden they're just labeled as one, and the police blanket comes down on them. How do people get in touch with you, Fahd? How can the people keep informed about the progress that you're making, or try to help if they'd like to?
Well, you can check out our website, drumnyc, drumnyc.org. From there, you can send an email to get signed up on our email list. If any of your listeners are folks that are from the South Asian community, we'd welcome them to be a part of our organization. And if other people are interested, we always have lots of amazing allies that are doing amazing work for NYPD accountability. And really, you know, the issues of whether it's stop and frisk, surveillance, they're all interlinked together. They indicate a similar mindset about the NYPD and how they treat all of our communities.
DrumNYC.org.
Yes.
Excellent. Fahd Ahmed, thank you very much. We wish you every success, and we truly appreciate your being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
But we cannot function we can feel nothing at all. They hurt us at home, they beat us at school. Hate us when we're clever, despise us when we're fools.
Today we'll examine in depth how the United States reached the recent crisis with regard to the debt ceiling. And if you think it's just the Tea Party that wants to cut current government benefits, such as Social Security and Medicare, you'd be wrong. It's also the Obama administration. Joining us is Professor Jack Rasmus, who teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. He's the author of the recently published book, Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few.
Jack Rasmus, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
I've been reading your recent excellent articles on the debt ceiling crisis and the government shutdown. And as you frame it, you say there Democrats and Republicans are really two wings of the same capitalist party, and then you got the Tea Party, the Tea Publicans, you call them, thrown into the mix. So let me ask you, what do you see the interests of both the Democrats and the Republicans in what's going on now?
Well, the Republicans' main strategic focus for some time, since 2011, has been to cut the deficit at the expense of discretionary spending, and in particular to target Social Security and Medicaid, the big items. And secondly, in the process, to try to extract as much in terms of tax cuts, both for wealthy investors, households, and for corporations. In the fiscal cliff deal of last year, they succeeded significantly in pushing through most of the Bush tax cuts. If you remember, during last decade, Bush tax cuts trillions of dollars, and Obama extended them for 2 years. They were supposed to expire in 2010, but he extended them for 2 years, and then that came to a sort of decision at the end of 2012. Well, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that was worth $4.6 trillion over the next decade, and Republicans got $4 trillion of that pushed through. Just a token, $60 billion a year is what Obama was able to achieve, and it wasn't really that, because the fiscal cliff tax deal liberalized some of the taxes on wealthy individuals. It gave them a bigger inheritance tax, settled more liberally the alternative minimum tax, and made all the taxes permanent. So if you look at the whole history of this, in 2011, what did the Republicans get by using the debt ceiling threat hammer? The deal in August 2011, was $1 trillion immediately of discretionary spending cuts, and nothing else. The Democrats didn't get any kind of tax hikes on the rich at the time. It also included a $1.2 trillion, what they call sequestered additional discretionary spending cuts. So the Republicans in the last 2 years have cut $2.2 trillion in government spending. We're just beginning to feel the impact of the sequester, by the way, just now in this budget here, October 2013. So they got $2.2 trillion. They got $4 trillion in tax cuts, 80% of which go to the wealthy. So they're doing pretty good, and it's not surprising that they're trying to use that same strategy once again. And this past August 2013, the Republicans said that's what they're going to do. They're going to use the debt ceiling in order to extract more spending cuts, this time Social Security, Medicare, and probably more tax cuts, this time for the corporations, not for wealthy individuals.
What are the Democrats willing to do in terms of opposing this or going along with it? What are they doing, particularly with respect to Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at Obama's 2014 current budget, which he put forth this past March, he's already called for $630 billion in Social Security and Medicare cuts. $630 billion. That's a starting point. That's a beginning of the negotiation. So I'm sure the Republicans are looking at, well, how much more can we add to that? And they'll probably get a couple hundred billion more added to that in terms of cuts. And I think Obama is going to let them make that proposal. And that's what you're going to see things now turn to in negotiations. You know, the original Republican strategy, repeat here in August. What's happened is that the Tea Party injected themselves in this thing. We've got 2.5 parties in Congress now. Tea Party is a faction of the Republican Party, and it's kind of terrorizing the Republican Party because even though it's a minority in the House, if the others don't go along with Tea Party initiatives, then the groups like Heritage Action and American Enterprise Institute and others push candidates to run and upset them in primaries. So they're terrified, and Boehner's terrified about keeping his job. He needs their support. So they kind of upset this grand plan of the Republicans, use debt ceiling to extract general tax cut and general spending cuts, focus on Social Security, Medicare. The Tea Party, injected into this whole process in September and focused it all on Obamacare. But they're in retreat now. As I've been saying for some time, that was just a grandstand. They know they couldn't achieve it, but these Tea Partiers are grandstanding for elections. And the Tea Party sees ACA, Obamacare, as a way to deepen their control and influence within the Republican Party in the next midterm elections. This is all about midterm elections next year, really. A lot of positioning and so forth going on. But obviously, the ACA could not really be the issue.
The ACA is Obamacare, right?
Obamacare, right. And they've backed off of this. I mean, clearly, you see the latest positions going on in the House-Senate negotiations. They're no longer declaring the Tea Party, that you have to defund Obamacare. They've even dropped the medical device tax delay, income verification on the poor. Poorer workers in the ACA. And what they've got now is this token face-saving deal of, okay, we're going to end the subsidies under ACA for Congress members and their staffers. So Tea Party just wants, at this point, some sort of a face-saving thing to say, hey, see, we did the impossible. We got a bill changed after it was passed, and we'll take another swipe at this next year in just before the midterm elections. You'll see this happen again.
You've given us some sense of how much Obama has been willing to give away, certainly in Social Security and Medicare, which I think needs some emphasis here. But the normal thing I hear on the street or from my friends and everything is that the crisis we're in right now, having to do with the debt ceiling as well as the government shutdown, there's nothing Obama could have done about that. That's the Tea Party. Email I get is, get rid of the Tea Party, you know, support this Democrat, do this, do this. Maybe that's not a good way to look at it because it's a narrow way, but just give me a sense of how right is that position. Could Obama have done anything, or is this just the way it's going now?
Well, there's a big debate whether Obama can extend the debt ceiling himself, whether he has a constitutional authority to do that. That's a debatable point. There are arguments pro and con. But in a real crisis, he probably could have taken the position that says, okay, you're undermining the economy and the country and so forth. I'm going to do an interim extension of the debt ceiling until you folks get your act in order here. That's an argument. It's a theoretical argument. It's hard to tell how much it is true or not. But Obama's taken the position he doesn't have that authority. Unilaterally, he said that. He doesn't want to do that. Although technically he might be able to do that. As far as the shutdown is concerned, well, that is a Tea Party problem, which is a Republican Party problem because the Tea Party is running amok. And it's got the Republican leadership and others pretty much terrorized that they're going to lose primaries. And that's the big change going on here.
Politically, Jack, you read about Ted Cruz and Ted Cruz's father who wants to set up a theocratic state. So are there differences inside of the Tea Party, some being more libertarian and other ones being more, you know, the utter religious right? What's going on in that faction?
Well, I think in the Tea Party, you have two groups. One wing of the Tea Party, or maybe you'd call it a feather, since the Tea Party is a wing of the Republican Party, is truly ideological. You know, the Rand Pauls and people like that. But there's another group that is really opportunist. You know, they're playing the Tea Party trend. They're riding the crest of the Tea Party. And the people behind the Tea Party out there in the grassroots, you know, the billionaires who are funding it, and the Heritage Action groups, you know, super right-wing groups that are really pushing it. So I think there's opportunists, and I think there's confused ideologues, and that's how I would distinguish. I think Cruz is a real opportunist here. He sees a way of injecting himself into the candidacy here next time around. It's interesting to see how guys like Paul Ryan are, you know, carefully trying to keep a foot in both camps, because Ryan knows if he's going to run for president on the Republican ticket, he's going to need big corporate financial support for doing that, and he can't look like he's too crazy. He's trying to straddle the fence there. It's really interesting to watch. Last week he came out and pretty much said, "Oh, we can't push the ACA stuff. We got to be, you know, more reasonable about this." You know, you see John Boehner a weekend past, not this past weekend, before, goes on TV and kind of also takes a straddling position. He's got to officially indicate he's strong against the ACA, but, you know, he gave signals. And then last week we started to see this let's defund Obamacare thing collapse. And I predict that there's going to be a settlement, just as I did before 2 months before the fiscal cliff deal. As I said then, that, you know, what you're going to see is Obama blocking with corporate pressure on the leadership in the Republicans, and all three of them then giving the Tea Party, you know, a choice of agreeing or not. And that was the settlement we got out of the fiscal cliff there. You know, at the last minute, Business Roundtable and others clearly blocked with Obama, put pressure on Republican leadership, which then together they all put pressure on the Tea Party. But they gave him a nice sweet deal, as I described, with the fiscal cliff, with the tax cut. And that was the whole strategy that was going to be repeated. I call that the well-orchestrated dance here, starting in August. But the Tea Party faction, as I said, injected and temporarily upset the apple cart.
Well, Jack, you're out on the West Coast in San Francisco, and I know you work with and speak with labor groups a lot. When you're with those groups and you talk long range and strategize, what do we do to get out of this box where we've got two business parties and then another one with feathers on that's kind of a faction of one of the business parties, and looks like we got nothing? So what's your thinking in respect to that problem?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of people in the grassroots level in organized labor, in the unions and their friends and so forth, realize that the two-party system, the Democrats, are just not delivering anymore. Less and less. We couldn't even get card check out of this administration.
What's
when they had control.
Card check is card check.
Oh, card check is when unions members or potential members can simply sign a card indicating they want the union to represent them, rather than going through this months and sometimes years-long election process to get a union, in which the employers have all the tactical advantages and are able to pretty much thwart union organizing efforts. That's been going on for decades, and labor, organized labor, said, you know, we got to go to the process we had during World War II, where people can just indicate whether they want a union or not and not be scared. Well, that was kind of not such a earth-shaking deal, because union membership has collapsed. Last year, union members lost 500,000, unions lost 500,000 members in 2012, even as, you know, 1.5 million new jobs were created. I mean, that's never happened before. Something really dangerous is going on for the labor movement, and if it continues in its present strategy of relying almost totally for gains on the Democratic Party, it's going to be gone in a decade, I predict. there is talk at the local level about, gee, maybe, you know, we ought to think about some new strategy here, or why are we always going back hat in hand to the Democrats who aren't delivering? But there's splits in the labor movement on that, and as you get higher up in the hierarchy, you know, they're totally committed to staying with the Democratic Party, and as they lose more and more members, they become even more dependent on handouts that get smaller and smaller from the Democrats. But there's a lot of grassroots discontent with that.
Yeah, we see it on a national level with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers trying to figure out a new strategy to help workers in New York City. We've got brand workers also trying to figure out a new strategy without having to go through the National Relations Act proceeds. But with respect to political parties, is there discussion out on the West Coast about unions trying to form a party made up of union members and their allies?
No, but there is a nationwide formation that's called the Emergency Labor Network, or Labor Fight Back Network, of experience, about 100 or so experienced unionists, a long time, and more youthful unionists and so forth, who are for this idea of independent political action. Maybe it's not time yet to form a labor party, but certainly labor and unions should be more independent from the two parties or the two wings of the one party, whatever. That group has been gaining a lot of respect, although it's not a substitute for a political party as such. But other than that, you know, on the West Coast per se, you know, I don't see any real effort to move in that direction among the unions on the West Coast. They're so preoccupied with trying to survive, you know. And the problem is, as you are under more and more attack and you're losing ground, it's easy to fall further and further under the skirt of the Democratic Party because you're weaker and you're more desperate for any kind of support. And that's kind of the major trend that's going on.
I want to just go back to what's happened with Medicare, Social Security under the Democrats for 8 years. You said something about there's been cuts to it, et cetera. Can you give us a sense of what that is? And was that Obama's only choice at those points?
Now, you know, Obama has been in favor of cutting Social Security for quite some time. In fact, way back when the first debt ceiling deal in August 2011 got close, he tried to propose a grand bargain. And in that, quote, grand bargain with Boehner at the time, he directly got in negotiations with Boehner, he proposed to cut Social Security and Medicare by some 700 and some billion. As a deal. In other words, they tried to offer that as a combined solution with the debt ceiling and so forth, but Obama wanted some tax hikes on the rich as part of that, and of course, Boehner and Republicans won't agree to any kind of tax hikes, only tax cuts. So Obama has been for that from the very beginning, and if you look at, even before that, the Simpson-Bowles Commission on Deficit Cutting, which came out with a ruling right after the midterm 2010 elections, called for hundreds of billions of cuts in Social Security and Medicare. And Obama has been in favor of that for quite some time. He's also been in favor, by the way, of cutting the corporate tax rate from 35% to 28%. I mean, that's a Republican proposal. So cut Social Security, cut corporate taxes. Boy, that doesn't sound like the Democratic Party of years past. So he's committed to doing that. The question is just how you're going to do it. And we know what he has proposed, Obama, is $630 billion in cuts in Social Security as a start point for negotiations.
Jack, thank you very much. We're kind of down to the wire here. Jack Rasmus, you're the author of the recent Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few. Maybe have another discussion when we see what happens with the government shutdown and the debt ceiling crisis. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you again, Jack. I really appreciate it.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.
Thank you.